Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. It's great to have you with us. If you're listening in real time, it's Friday afternoon, so we're all getting set for a great show, and then we're out of here. Jim Galloway, you're heading home for yard work over the weekend?
Maybe some woodworking.
A little woodworking?
A little woodworking. Maybe work off some of this pie that Tim Eccles is tempting us with.
Yeah, we'll talk about that pie in just a second. Jim Galloway, of course, you all know, the lead political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. You read his columns on Wednesday and Sundays in the Dead Tree edition of the paper. And, of course, he oversees the Political Insider blog at myajc.com. He also was the reason that we are going to talk to a very special guest in a few minutes about the incredible Twitter campaign that the Russians launched here in the United States before, during, and after the 2016 presidential election. Loretta Lepore, it's Friday. You're back with us. We're always glad to have you here, former press secretary to Governor Sonny Perdue, Republican strategist. Carly Fiorina's campaign chair during her presidential run here in Georgia. The list goes on.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here. Happy Friday, everybody.
And, you know, the tweets always light up when Buddy Darden, former Democratic congressman from Cobb County, is in the studio. Buddy, are you prepared for all of the praise?
I'm prepared because I'm taking time out from the visit of my oldest granddaughter this weekend, Catherine Lillian Brennan.
We need to get this guy a Twitter handle. It needs to be Uncle Buddy.
Yeah, Uncle Buddy, right.
Well, I've got a Twitter account. I just never do tweet.
Okay. Yeah. And Public Service Commissioner Tim Eccles joins us as well. And as Jim Galloway mentioned, Tim, you've endeared yourself to us forever, bringing over pieces of pie from the Silver Skillet, which is right down the street from our Midtown studios. I just had the coconut cream. It's pretty good.
It is. It's great to be here, and I'm glad to have my first grandchild since I was last in here.
Yeah, congratulations
Thank
on
you.
That. Tim is going to especially play a big role in the second half of our show, because as many of you know, there's been so much controversy over Southern Company Georgia Power's construction of new towers out at the Plant Vogtle nuclear plant. They initially were budgeted for around $7+ billion. All of a sudden this week we learn, no, the price tag has risen by an additional $1.1 billion. And later in the show, we'll engage Tim in a conversation about what that means to all of us who live in the state of Georgia. But let's start by talking about this remarkable study report, which was put out by the Social Media Listening Center at Clemson University. Two researchers there, Darren Linville and Patrick Warren, they took a look. Let me go back just a step, and then we'll talk to you, Patrick Warren. We're very glad you're here joining us from a studio. Are you at Clemson?
Yes, sir. I'm at Clemson, but I didn't receive my pie.
No. I'm so sorry. So let me back up just a step. June of 2018, the House Intel Committee released a list of, I think, 3,800 plus accounts associated with the Internet Research Agency, which, of course, is a Russian troll factory. And you guys got a hold of those 3,800 accounts. I think I've got this right. And you looked into this. You were able to use research you do in other areas to find 3 million Twitter messages that had been created or somehow manipulated in that Russian boiler room between February of 2012 and just this past May. You were able to categorize them. There were like 617 right-wing troll handles, 230 left-wing troll handles, and there were some 120-plus fearmonger troll handles. As a starting point, have I got that right?
That's right. We were able to break these accounts up broadly into six categories, but the left-wing and right-wing trolls were certainly the most dominant of those, and we can talk more about them if you'd like.
Yeah, we want to talk about them for sure. So let's get into that right now. Jim Galloway, why don't you start things going?
Okay. Dr. Warren, if you could explain the social media learning center, what just the platform that you were able to use, because you and Linville just kind of were sitting around, I think, over a couple of beers, and you kind of realized that you had something in available that nobody else did.
That's right. So actually, the first list was released in November of last year, and there were about 2,500 accounts on that list. And we were sitting around over Christmas break and chatting about, and we heard that this had been released and realized that this was a great opportunity for us to make a contribution to the conversation, because here at Clemson, we have access to the Social Media Listening Center. And for the most part, that's used for real-time tracking of sort of social media trends, what people are talking about. I'm sure it does a lot of information about Clemson football. And But it has this other ability that is not used as much, but we realized would be super useful for this, which is that it has an archive. It has a long archive of every tweet that showed up in Twitter at that point.
Even if it's been deleted, right?
Correct, because it scrapes in real time. So if you tweet something, it's going to come looking for it there within a day or two. And if it finds it, it's going to save it. And even if you delete it, it's still in the database.
And we should point out that's very important to what you were able to then move on and do, because Twitter did delete most of those, if not all of the accounts you discovered, so that there was no remaining evidence. And if it weren't for that scraper, you wouldn't have had the information you ended up using.
That's correct. I mean, there are ways to try to uncover deleted tweets, but nothing as comprehensive as this.
You know what's interesting about this to me, Loretta, is, and I said it at the very top of the show, Russian interference in our election, and I think that both of our researchers would say, both Darren and Patrick would say, beyond that, in our society in a more general way, we hear about it all the time. It's been a big story in the news for a couple of years. But we very rarely kind of can get hold of evidence that shows us how it might affect us in our day-to-day lives, you know?
Well, I think that's true. I think that we've seen kind of a crescendo with regard to Russian interference, particularly in the social media platforms. We saw a while back their interference with respect to Facebook, and that sort of hit a climax, and in particular with how Congress was looking at what Facebook was doing and how Facebook was screening accounts coming out of Russia and interference in that regard. And now I think this research here provides a whole nother level of circumspection about what's being done to our political process through these platforms.
You know, it's interesting. Patrick, you were quoted, or maybe it was Darren who was quoted, as saying at one point, the IRA, the Internet Research Agency, is engaged in what is not simply political warfare, but industrialized political warfare. What do you mean by that?
Well, if you go and look at how these accounts are constructed, they're basically interchangeable parts. So we talk about these right troll accounts. They hardly have personalities to them at all. They're near identical copies of each other. They're not bots. They are operated by humans, but they're operated in such a way that you could exchange one for the other and it would pretty much have no change. And they can just replicate these and replicate these. That's what we mean by industrial.
So a human operator 1 hour could be operating a left troll account, and then the next hour switch over and use the right troll account, correct?
That's absolutely right. If you zoom in, you know, you can zoom in very specifically in these data, and you can see it. At 11 p.m., they're working hard on the right accounts, and at 12 p.m., they've quit using the right accounts, and they're working hard on the left accounts. They can't do both at once because, you know, they only have one computer they're sitting in front of.
Doctor, how would the average person who has a Twitter account, doesn't really tweet much, but at least monitors others, what would cause that person to find one of these accounts?
Well, one of their goals was to try to infiltrate in some way, and the way that they would do that is often they would comment or retweet accounts that you may already be following. So you may be following, for instance, Sean Hannity. This is the journalist that gets most mentioned by the Twitter trolls.
I hesitate to use that term with Sean Hannity, but go ahead.
But he's a Democrat.
Okay. And so they may enter into conversations that are happening in response to Sean Hannity's tweets, or they may retweet Sean Hannity's tweets with a little comment. You might pick that up and say, oh, this sounds interesting. Let me follow this guy now.
So, So let me read, and then we'll keep everybody. Please join in. Here are some sample tweets that again were deleted, but your scraper caught them. Here's quote: Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Which one is worse, Lucifer, Satan, or the devil? And that was tweeted from an account called Gwenny that directed readers to a YouTube video. I don't know whether that's, frankly, a left or a right tweet, but there are any number. It's not about electing our next president. It's about giving up everything we stand for or fighting back. That's a Wake Up America tweet. The idea of all these tweets, believe, is not to favor one side or the other, although Donald Trump seems to have been left alone as an individual candidate during his campaign, whereas McCain and others were the targets of some of this. It's simply to sow chaos on both sides, yeah?
I think that's definitely right. So a timely point to make on this is if you look at their activity around Charlottesville, that was a year ago now, and to see what they do. There's a recent BuzzFeed article about this, and they looked, and there was a huge spike in troll activity after Charlottesville. Why? Because there was a lot of back and forth, you know, oh, there's good people on both sides, this sort of back and forth, and they just they clamp onto those sorts of conflicts and try to exaggerate them, make them even bigger than they are.
Right. In the paper you wrote with Linville, you said that if you were within the right troll universe, kind of the far right were attacking the moderate Republicans, and then on the left side you had the further left attacking the moderates on the Democratic side, mostly Hillary Clinton. Correct.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They're trying to make the extremes of each side seem more prominent than they really are.
But is there any way, Doctor, that you could determine how much and how many people are affected by all this? It still seems to me to be kind of a nebulous or remote chance of reaching the average person.
Well, we can measure the number of times these accounts were mentioned on Twitter as a whole. So I don't know how many times their tweets were read, but I know how many times someone talked about one of these accounts on Twitter. And these are in the period before they were identified. So it's not like I was talking about it as a troll account. Rather, I was interacting with them in a more natural way. And what we see is in the 2 years, basically a year after and a year before the election, there were 20 million mentions of these trolls on Twitter. So that's 20 million people Wow. who interacted with these trolls in some way. Now, there's probably untold people on top of that who merely read what they said. And didn't react.
Dr. Warren, okay, tell me what kind of reaction this has gotten from officialdom, from Washington, from the Capitol. If you can, tell me if the CIA has been interested.
So I can neither confirm nor deny any interest from the CIA. We have been invited to come and speak with some congressional staffers, and we're going to do that later in the fall, later in the summer.
You had mentioned that many of these tweets were deleted by Twitter itself. Why were they deleted? Were these tweets that Twitter identified as being circumspect in some way and deleted them, or were these just tweets that individuals deleted?
So we have both cases. The reason that none of these tweets are available now is because Twitter deleted the account. And when Twitter deletes an account, all of the tweets of that account are now gone from the public profile. And so that's why, for the most part, that's why these tweets are no longer available, because Twitter identified these accounts as troll accounts and shut them down.
Tim?
Hey, Dr. Warren, I'm an avid Twitter user. I've tweeted about 27,000 times over the last 11 years. Here's my question. Are you counting, like, if someone follows one of these accounts, is that factor into the data point that you're using?
We are able to track the number of followers that the trolls have, and some of them grow exponentially. Some of them barely get any followers. And so that is something we're able to track. When I say mentions, though, that's not followers. That's, I mean, it could be people who follow the accounts, but it could just be people who see something that this troll said and then like it. I'm not just like it, retweet it or comment on it.
Yeah, follow-up question. How much impact do you feel like, and I don't know if your research has been able to deduce this, does a single Twitter handle or a single tweet have in behavior or attitude of the people who may be reading it?
Obviously, that's like the $100 million question, right? So did this affect turnout behavior, voting behavior, donation behavior? And it's really hard because we have very little geography in these data. So I can see who retweeted the trolls, but I don't know where those people are. I can back it out in some ways, but it's so imperfect. And certainly I don't have individual information about the individuals who retweeted. And so to tell, like, if they acted differently because of those interactions is so difficult. We don't know. We would love, I mean, you know, it's such a cop out, but future research, I guess. I mean, we would love to answer that, but we don't know the answer.
Well, let's, if you can, you folks have also, you two have also taken this file of 3 million emails and you've handed it over to 538.com and invited people to take a look at it. What do you think, what are the possibilities there?
Well, they're endless. So let me tell you about one thing that totally surprised me. So we posted these data on 538, and we started to get a lot of requests for interviews with European media, Italy, Spain, Israel. They didn't know that they were subject to this attack. And so when we posted the tweets, suddenly it kind of opened their eyes to, you know, 1 million of these 3 million tweets are not in English.
So,
and I don't think people realize the extent to which this is an international effort.
So let me follow up on that, because we actually got from people watching on Facebook Live, we're starting to get a lot of messages. And by the way, if you're not watching right now, but you want to go to the GPB news page on Facebook and you can watch what's going on. Paula Sedlacek mentioned that. She says you can go over to 538 and there's a summary of the subject and where the tweets are directed. You can participate in researching them if you're so inclined. So help us understand that. You passed on this database to 538. And you're saying that if we go to that page on 538, we can actually drill down and look at what? Individual tweets?
So 538 just provided the data in a format that would be good for data researchers, but probably not good for just anybody. But people have taken that data and have already built a number of databases that you can do exactly what you described. You can go to the 538 article, and then there will be links off that to various things that people have done with these data. And one of those is a very nice search page where you can search by topic, you can search by region, you can search by language, you can search by this right-left troll account category that we gave it. Yeah, it's super powerful. This is part of why we did it. We're not computer scientists. We knew that people would do amazing things with these data once we release
it. Jim, I want to point out that this sounds a little bit abstract, perhaps. This gets very close to home. The AJC is one of the Twitter, you have a Twitter handle that was used to pass troll attacks.
Right. Basically, to imbue themselves with a bit of legitimacy, they would focus on local news feeds. And in Atlanta, I believe, Dr. Warren, if I'm not correct, you identified the primary AJC Twitter feed as
Fox
one of those
5,
sources,
and local Fox 5,
and the Fox 5 TV station is one.
That's correct. So they created their own fake local news feed.
Atlanta
that they
Online, I think.
That's exactly right, where they aggregated a few real local news feeds and basically stole all their content in order to, you know, pretend to be a local news agency.
Okay.
So along those lines, I wanted to point out in 538, one of the illustrations that's on there is from a reporter with the Portland paper who took it down to a granular level to the tweets that impacted and affected particular elected officials in the Portland and Oregon community. So how many of these tweets were directed at the governor, for instance?
Susan Collins was a big target in
Maine.
Right.
So it was very interesting to see how the reporters did this anybody could really go in there that had an interest, to their point, to look at this data and then slice and dice it depending on what information they wanted to glean.
Our producer, Robert Jimison, in looking at the 538 data, noticed that there was a tweet that was virtually the same as a tweet that President Trump had sent out virtually simultaneously, and I'm not sure whether you're aware, Patrick, of this particular instance, but it was a little bit hard to know whether the troll tweet came first or the president's tweet came first. And that's not to suggest there's any cooperation between the two, but maybe they're looking at the president's tweets, too.
Well, Donald Trump is definitely the most mentioned name, like, of an individual in the whole database. They do a lot of retweeting of all kinds of folks, including Donald Trump, for sure.
All right. So let me open this up a little bit. Let me step back and ask all of you to help me with this, get engaged in this part of the conversation. We have been engaged in an ongoing debate in this country for a couple of years about just how significant Russian intervention in our elections has been. And we obviously know that the president keeps pushing back, despite the fact that our intelligence agencies, of course, they did interfere and continue to interfere. So when you look at what Darren Linville and Patrick Warren have presented to us, what do you say about how concerned we ought to be about how this sort of disinformation gets into the mainstream, buddy?
I think the president's got to decouple the concept of whether or not he was aided by this effort and the real threat that's out there. We need to forget about it. The election's over. So he needs to concentrate on the fact that this must be stopped and doesn't go on, and forget about that. This is not about Donald Trump. This is about the security of the United States and the integrity of the information that our senators receive.
Well, I think it's pretty conclusive that the Russians have interfered, that we have a common understanding about that. I think the other thing that we now have a common understanding about is that whether the Russians continue to tweet or whether they continue to try to hack into databases, that they don't even have to go that far because they have created so much doubt with the electorate. They have sown so much chaos and discomfort amongst the electorate that they have been successful to date in what they've been trying to accomplish. And that's a concern in and of itself, you know, that voters feel that when they cast their ballots or when they register to vote, that their information is secure and that their vote counts. And when you have just, you know, when you have the threat that Russia is going in there and disrupting somehow our voter registration systems, it sows discontent amongst the electorate.
You know, I think the Russians have gotten a lot of press and credit for all of this when we've had so many scams on the internet leading up to the 2016. I remember we had a Nigerian person try to scam our family over purchasing a horse to the point that they sent us a cashier's check that was fake to buy this horse for this little girl. Quote unquote. And so there's been spear phishing. You know, I'm not so much concerned about the nationality. I'm concerned about any spear phishing for power company executives, power plants, you know, government agencies. It doesn't matter to me who's doing it. I just want to tighten up the entire thing, regardless of what the nationality of the offender is.
Yeah. Okay. And Dr. Warren, if to that point, where does the IRA, the Internet Research Agency, where does it go next? How is it morphing from a 2016 campaign into the 2018 and a 2020 version?
Well, so it's important to note that we only have the tweets from the accounts that Twitter has identified. And so most of the accounts that are active now are probably not even on our list, right? Mm-hmm. I'll also note that this is not an election thing, not exclusively. So there were more tweets by the IRA in the year after the 2016 election than there were in the year before the 2016 election. So the idea that this was just sort of an attack on the election and that's all that they're doing, that's misguided. That's something that they were doing. But they've continued to try to interfere in the political conversation after that. And if anything, they ramped it up. And so are they active now? I'm sure that they're active now. They may not be the IRA. We know that building is closed. I think the other thing to note is super complementary with their other computer hacking attacks. So we see the biggest one-day spike in troll activity is the day before John Podesta's emails were released. And so they hack the emails. They sort of seed the ground to make sure that the extreme left of the Democratic Party is going to be the most active part of the conversation on the day that the John Podesta emails are released. And those released and those emails then indicate that there may have been something hinky about the Democratic primary process. It's just it's all one big package.
All right. We have got to get to a break, and we should point out, by the way, that what you're talking about now is the potential that the WikiLeaks and the IRA were working in concert around this big data dump, which probably played an enormous role in how the Clinton campaign, at least the momentum, the rhythm of their campaign as they tried to respond to all of this. Patrick Warren, we are out of time for this part of the show today, but for people who have not had a chance to see the work you've been doing, number one, you can go to the Political Insider blog at myajc.com. Jim, you've written a terrific column about it. You can go to 538oneword.com and look at what they're doing. The Washington Post has reported on this. Patrick, you've had an enormous impact for a thing that started over a couple of beers in Clemson, South Carolina. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.
All right. We have got to get a break in. We'll come back, talk a little more about this, and then we're going to talk to the Public Service Commissioner with us at the table about what the heck the PSC is going to make of a $1.1 billion increase in the cost of new work at Plant Vogtle. This is Political Rewind.
You know, selling a car can be a hassle, but donating it is a whole different story. Let us take it off your hands or off your driveway and turn it into public radio and maybe even a tax deduction. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl, the host of Marketplace, and here is how to donate.
Call 877-GPB-1-CAR or donate securely online at gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
We're back on Political Rewind. Loretta Lepore, Buddy Darden, Jim Galloway, and Tim Echols from the Public Service Commission, a Public Service Commissioner, all here. You can watch us live on Facebook if you just go to the GPB news page there. And we have a lot of people starting to line up who want to talk to you, Tim Echols, about Plant Vogtle. We'll get to that in just a second. Before we do, Loretta, let me just go back on this other story that we just talked about and ask you this, you know, one of the themes that we've had on this show recently, and it related to some of the concerns being expressed in some cases for partisan reasons about the safety of Georgia's elections, whether our ballots are counted accurately, that sort of thing. And that has led people to wonder if they can trust the entire election process, whether it's a Democrat who wins or a Republican wins. All of this erodes the trust that we have in our institutions. Yes.
Well, that was the point I was trying to make earlier, is that, you know, there doesn't have to be an actual act for the electorate to feel insecure. And when they're feeling insecure, it leads to voter suppression. It leads to low voter turnout. You know, there was a story this week by Stateline, which is a subsidiary of Pew. And it was talking about elections in Maryland, the most recent election cycle in Maryland, in which they had a software glitch. It was merely a software glitch. But 3 days in advance of the election, they had to notify 80,000 voters that they were no longer registered. And Maryland is a you can register on the day of the election in Maryland. And so they were told they can register on the day and file use a provisional ballot. And every elector, all of the poll workers had lists of these 80,000 people. What do you think the outcome of that was? low voter turnout. And where it was most critical was in really tight races where you had a margin of 50 or 80 votes. And if you're having 80,000 people impacted, so this is the point that those organizations that are these third party organizations that are watching the technology and watching what's happening are so concerned about, is that there's any little thing with technology that can throw off the course of an election.
And this is further compounded by the fact that all of us who've lost an election from time to time think surely there must have been something wrong with the process.
Absolutely.
With. So this takes away from the overall efficacy and credibility of the process.
You know, I think we've got to help our colleagues and our workers and our students coming up to understand the exposure and the risk they have with email, for example. I was at Microsoft, and they were saying they had a red team and a blue team. And if their red team or blue team could get any Microsoft employee, this is in Redmond, a huge, huge company, if they could get them to bite on a spear phishing, they got a $1,000 bonus. And then that person was fired. The person who opened the email and typed in the information, they were fired. And then the person that got them to do it was given a bonus. You can bet these Microsoft employees are keenly aware of emails and not doing something stupid. And so I think we need to help train our folks that work in our companies to understand it's open and beware of what's coming into your inbox.
All right. It's a story that's not going to end anytime soon. I got an interesting message from Cindy Simpson about all this. She says, "We the people are going to have to battle this with information about how the attack was staged. Like we are hearing from Patrick, if people recognize the goals of the program were so specifically aimed at division, maybe at least part of the population can get inoculated and immunized. The problem with that is we don't know what's true and what's not true." I get that. That's a good sentiment. But we simply do not know what to make of the things that we see in our Twitter feeds and whatever. All right. Let's go on to Tim Echols. The reason you were very gracious to come in here and join us for the conversation today. Let me just very briefly set the stage. There's been controversy for quite some time now about the twin units that George Power Southern Company is adding out at Plant Vogtle, two new nuclear units being built in Burke County. We had a bankruptcy that disrupted all this. Westinghouse, which was building these plants, went bankrupt. There were questions about how they were now going to be paid for. You went on as one of the members, well, I shouldn't say you specifically. The Public Service Commission, after looking at all the problems, certified a $7.3 billion price tag, which is what Georgia Power told you would be the cost to complete the construction after all of the financial problems. And they said it would be self-financed. This week, we learn from Georgia Power, they got it a little wrong. They need to add $1.1 billion on top of the $7.3 billion that had already been approved. Have I got that right?
Yeah, but the average ratepayer who's not listening to the show or reading the paper probably will not know anything that's going on, because they haven't had an increase in base rate since 2013. We've had two fuel prices decreases on the bill, $5 a piece a month since December of 15. We've had three refunds this year, $25 each. There's been a lowering of the pre-charge on the bill because of the Toshiba refund of about 20%.
I said Westinghouse. Yes. Toshiba.
No, you were right.
It was Westinghouse. Okay.
Westinghouse. And so the average person out there, they're not going to see the increase on their bills until these reactors are up and running in 2022.
But that doesn't mean that they won't suddenly see their share of a $1.1 billion additional price tag at some point.
No, they're not going to see it until the end.
Yes, but then they will, is my point.
On this particular price increase, the power company's eating it. and rightly so. And talking to just two of my colleagues, I haven't talked to McDonald and Eaton and Everett, but when I talked to Pridemore and Eaton, they were livid about this. And believe me, the power company's not interested in bringing something to us only to have them slap down over there. They don't like to lose. And so they were aware that these commissioners, no way were they giving them the money. So I think they rightly decided to eat the $1.1 billion. And then after they ate the $1.1 billion, their stock dropped about 4%, which was the equivalent of another $2.2 billion. So this week has been a very bad week for Georgia Power and the Southern Company.
Okay, Tim, if I could ask you two questions about this. Number one, what was the cause of the overrun? What do they attribute the $1.1 billion extra cost?
They attribute it to their base capital forecast is what they're saying.
I don't know what that means.
Yeah, which means we're paying more for labor than we thought we were going to have to pay. I mean, we are short about 500 electricians out there. You're having to pay more and more to get them to come in and live there in the middle of nowhere to work on the plant. And you've got, at the Savannah River site, you've got a similar facility being built that's competing with our laborers. So we're having to pay more, and we're having to pay overtime, which Savannah River's not paying. So we're paying overtime to union workers to be out there to do the work, and we're only going to get more of them because we're short.
Okay, before we get some hate mail here, Waynesboro is a very, very nice place, and people do like to live there.
It's the bird dog capital of the South.
There you go. Yeah. Secondly, okay, you Georgia Power is absorbing this. What's the corporate risk here? I mean, that's a big pill to swallow.
We do want to say, as part of your being able to answer the question, is we've now learned that Moody's has downgraded their rating of Georgia Power, and they say it is because there's questions as to whether Georgia Power will be able to complete the project, and they're particularly concerned about whether the co-owners, Oglethorpe Power and the municipal,
MEAC,
whether they might want to pull out of the project altogether. So there is a big corporate risk here.
Yeah, and this $1.1 billion increase has triggered a vote for all of those principals coming up next month. So it is a concern, but Dalton Utilities, who owns a small share, had a sinking fund. They had already set money aside, so they're good. I don't think they're going anywhere. Oglethorpe had already set aside some contingency, and so I think they're going to stay in it. MEAG, which has Jacksonville Electric as a part of this, Jacksonville wants out of this project. MEAG has their name on the dotted line. I don't think they're going to let them escape their power purchase agreement commitment. In other words, Jacksonville was going to be buying part of the power for this. So I think if the partners stay with it, I think we're all good to continue. And certainly the ratepayers have benefited from what happened this week in the sense that they're not having to pay for it.
Just to remind our listeners, in layman's terms, MEAG refers to the municipally owned utilities such as Marietta Power and Union Power and the other cities. And Dalton is, of course, a separate entity here. But it also, in Oglethorpe, includes the people like Cobb EMC, Jackson County EMC, and all the electric membership corporations around the state. So this is concerns really every single utility customer in the state,
and
does
for
it
that
not.
Matter, it, any consumer who has a power provided by any of those authorities across the state.
Yeah, and I'm a member of Jackson EMC, who owns a very large share of that Oglethorpe share, and we don't have any other way in Jackson EMC to get money other than to take it from our membership. So I think it is going to be more difficult where, in this case, Southern Company, they let Georgia Power do this write down, and they infused Georgia Power with a chunk of cash to help Wall Street feel better about that. So, but, you know, For the average person, though, when we're finished, if they have a $150 electric bill, and when we put all of this in rates, it's going to go up about $17. They will have already paid the interest piece of it in advance. So it's not going to be as much as it sounds like when we're throwing around the word billion here on the show.
But Tim, let me ask you. It seems as if when we started rattling out all the electrical investments involved by all this myriad of power companies and power entities. Has this project gotten too big to fail?
I think it has gotten too big to fail, especially given that China's got four of these working now. I went to Shanghai in May and saw one of them, and the fact that four separate units are working right now as we speak, that gives us a lot of confidence to know that this is not some kind of theory anymore. We know these things will work. It's just a matter of getting through all the grunt work, which is a lot of the electrical stuff right now.
I was going to ask the same question a different way, but I'll go ahead and do it again, though. So isn't it true we've just got too much invested here, and we've come too far now just to walk away like they did over in South Carolina and some other venues?
Yeah, buddy, I think looking at South Carolina and seeing all the regulatory contentiousness over there, the impact it had on SCANA, the frustration from the governor's office, we don't want any of that here in Georgia. So really the only thing worse then this project going over is canceling.
All right, but so let me ask a very simple question. And I understand, Tim, that you don't have Georgia Power's books in front of you right now. What is the possibility that can Georgia Power afford another $1.1 billion? What is the risk that they don't have the resources to finish this, especially since we have no way of knowing whether there's going to be another increase coming up in the next couple of years?
Fortunately, their parent, Southern Company, located here in Atlanta, is very committed to this project. And Southern Company stepped in and helped them.
How much money does Southern Company? Do we know what is their total, cash reserve? Do we have any idea?
I have no idea.
Okay.
No.
Okay. Loretta, I'm interested in one aspect of what Tim is saying. This project increasingly feels to me like a Greek tragedy. Hubris, what happens when we get puffed up with pride? I mean, I get that Southern Company would argue we were looking out for the future electrical needs of the state and nuclear is the best way to go and all that sort of thing. But even a $17 increase on my bill, from my point of view, I can't help but wonder if I'm paying for hubris, for the pride. Georgia Power has got to have this project. That is not the kind of argument I could take to court, but it's a feeling that I have about this.
Well, that's that's a lot. I mean, I think that corporations and their shareholders, like a Georgia Power and a Southern Company, have so many other accountability measures built into what they do and the decisions they make that this decision is not predicated on hubris or pride. I think this is about providing an alternate energy source. I do think when you look at any major infrastructure project, and I remember back in the day when I was a reporter for CNN, I would get sent over to TVA in Tennessee to do stories over there all the time. These are hard to understand projects that require big numbers of investment. And it's hard for people to understand. Tim says $17 at the end of the day. That's hard for somebody who's sitting at home
to
process.
It is.
You simply can't really process that, how you go from $1.1 billion to $17. And so that requires an education campaign. And unfortunately, that is the responsibility of Georgia Power.
All right. I've got to get to a break. I'm really late on taking our final break of the show. When we come back, Jim, I want to ask, we got a couple PSC races on the ballot. Let's talk about whether this is going to play a role in the election. This is Rewind.
Did you know that the silicon for Silicon Valley comes from sand in North Carolina and that sand thieves stole part of a beach in Jamaica? I'm Ira Flatow on the next Science Friday, the amazing role sand plays in our lives. Plus, science and dance collide, from choreographing the Higgs boson to saving endangered sea turtles. It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
3 o'clock this afternoon on GPB.
Jim Galloway, Tim is feeling, I think, positive about the fact that George Power is going to pay for this themselves. And in fact, we did get a Facebook live post from someone who said thanks to the PSC for looking out for the consumer's interests here. He doesn't have to run for election this year. You have another, what, 4 years? Okay. How big a role is this going to play in the PSC race coming up?
I think it's going to get large. And it hasn't – you can see it percolating right now, just at a kind of a low boil right now. After Georgia Power's announcement, I got a nice press release from Don Randolph, who's the Democrat challenging incumbent Republican Tricia Pridemore in the one of the two races. And she was kind of offering Georgia Power a backhanded compliment. She said, congratulations on getting it right this time, because Georgia Power is absorbing that $1 million extra cost.
Billion,
excuse me, right. The other race, of course, is Republican incumbent Chuck Eaton versus Democrat Lindy Miller. And this is where it gets interesting, because Chuck is the only one the only PSC member who voted for the Vogel extension who's on the ballot. And so it could get pretty tough for him. He will have all his fellow PSC members at his side, I would guess, simply because they're all Republican and they're all in the same boat, and they probably don't want to leave him hanging.
But buddy, you know, Loretta made a really excellent point that in the long run, it's not the PSC that has to explain this, although I suppose they do, but it is George Power has to educate the public. I have a very emotional reaction to this, as you heard earlier, and Loretta talked me off the ledge.
I hope so, a little
which
bit.
Which is good. Still, the voters are going to have emotional reactions to this, too.
They're going to have emotional reactions, but at the same time, you got to put this thing in perspective. Every morning, I either go to McDonald's or Dunkin' Donuts, and used to be 99 cents, and now it's a dollar and a half, and sometimes goes over $2, and things cost more, and people really don't seem to complain about paying more for things they want. And I don't know anything more important than the power we receive, utilities we get, and I think we just got to accept as a fact of life this is something very valuable, and that the investors and also the consumers have got to share part of the cost.
Wait, okay, Jim, go ahead.
Okay, all right. The one thing I would point out here is that, and Tim, correct me if I'm wrong, but of the four candidates we have out there in the two PSC races, one Democrat and one Republican in each contest, I have not heard a single candidate yet say that the plug needs to be pulled on these two new reactors at Fort Vogel. Am I right there?
Well, the Democratic candidates are
making noises.
They are trashing the plant in the sense
they're trashing how it was financed.
Yeah, but it's still negative. Now, mm-hmm. Maybe if they get elected and they're sitting there, they change their mind, you know, if we have a vote on whether to go mm-hmm. or no go. But it seems to me that if we had a Democratic majority on the commission, that they would probably go the way of South Carolina and shut it down.
Let's remind people that you are a Republican member of the commission, so you do have that slight, you see things through that filter to some extent. Daniel Eason, one of our viewers on Facebook Live, asked a question that I recognize isn't a practical solution, but I think he raises an interesting point. He wants to know whether EMCs are not more accountable to their customers, to their members, because they are involved in a cooperative where the customers have more power. Is there anything to that?
Well, EMCs, you know, they're nonprofit organizations. Yeah. They have a board of directors. You see them at the annual meeting. You can see them at church. I think they are a little more nimble. But Oglethorpe is speaking for them. And so some EMCs opted to be into Vogel. EMCs like Cobb EMC's not in the Vogel deal. So once they're in it, they're not going to be able to get out of it. So I don't know that a Jackson EMC, like I'm a member of, can do anything other than to console their membership at this point.
Oh, God. You know, lost in all of this is the question that had been asked, especially after the bankruptcies here and in South Carolina, which was, Jim, is nuclear power the future? Is it really the right way for a power company to go? And we're obviously way, way past that stage at this point.
Well, I mean, this is the only active nuclear construction in the country right now. And there is a feeling, and Tim has been part of this argument, that you've got to keep this technology alive because eventually, in some circumstance, it's going to be crucial. And there is the argument, and I've seen it elsewhere, that wind and solar, even if you solve the storage problem, the capacity isn't going to be always there.
Yeah, that's right. I think we've learned from Germany, we've learned from California, that if you're going to move towards a CO2 reduction, you can't close coal plants and nuclear plants and replace them with gas plants because you're going backwards. Gas plants emit CO2. So after a Trump administration, after a Republican Congress, at some point, a Democratic administration will impose some kind of CO2 tax.
Buddy, real quick, because we're running out of time.
I want to shock you real quick with Tim just a second, because right now we've got a 5-member Republican majority. We've only got 2 up this time, so you're not going to have a Democratic majority of the PSC anytime for the foreseeable future. So I really don't think that we need to scare folks with the specter of a Democratic majority.
Yeah, but Buddy, Bubba McDonald and Doug Everett are stepping down in 2020.
All right,
that's in 2020.
I got Jim. I know you wanted to have a different discussion. I'm going to tee it up for our next show by asking a question that I know you want. We get from you on this one, Tim Echols, a very brief answer. Jim Galloway wrote a column last week about the dangers of hacking into our electric grid and the fact that Russians have already tried to do that in some instances. So all we can ask you to do today, so that we can talk about it and say what you said, is how dangerous is that? How much potential is there for Georgia's electric grid to be tampered with?
Yeah, we've really tightened things up. I don't have any concern about the Georgia grid, but that doesn't mean we stop trying to stay ahead of them. So I sleep easy at night because I know we're spending a lot of money on cyber, and we've got all of these protocols that we make these employees do.
Is the Georgia grid separate, totally separate from the other states?
No, not totally separate. It's very much tied into Alabama and Mississippi and the Southern Company system.
All right, we are completely out of time. Jim, this is a subject we should take up again and talk about in more detail at some point, but we've now got Tim Echols on the record as saying he feels he's going to sleep well, and that makes all of us happy. That's it for us for today. My thanks to Loretta Lepore. We'll see you again next Friday.
Sounds great.
Buddy Darden, Tim Echols, Jim Galloway, of course. I loved having you here today. You'll be back with me on Monday's show when we will move forward with Nsenga Burton is going to be one of the panelists on the show. Heath Garrett will be back on Monday. And one of the things I want to talk about real quick, you have about 20 seconds to tell us about the column that just went online for you, and it'll be in the Sunday paper that we can talk about on Monday.
It's about the secret debate that's happening that will determine whether the race for lieutenant governor will really matter in November.
Interesting. And what Galloway is saying is he doesn't think it matters if it's the Democrat or the Republican, because we'll explain on Monday, neither of them may have any power at all when they take that job in the state Senate. So that's it for us for another week of Political Rewind. Thanks all of you for being with us. Thank you to our friends out at WUGA who watch and listen to the show every Friday. We'll see you again next week. All of you have a great weekend. I'm Bill Nigut. Take care.